Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites. Your food is our passion.
Let's get the disclaimer out of the way. The historian Greg Jackson is not trying to downplay the anxieties and concerns of people who look at this cultural and political moment and say it's never been worse. He gets it. In his new book, Jackson says, of course, the internet and social media have changed things. The hyper-partisan divisions, public officials who've lost restraint, election anxiety, political violence. There are things about this moment that really are different. But Jackson is saying different isn't the same as unprecedented. This is the case he makes in the book. He isn't arguing history repeats itself. He's saying something more useful than that. Jackson says, if Americans will remember what we've already lived through, we'll gain perspective on the moment we're living through now. And his book has the stories to back him up. There's the congressman nearly beaten to death on the floor of the U.S. House, a media that traded in rumor and conspiracy theories, a disputed presidential election, and this story about Benjamin Franklin in 1872.
The Revolutionary War is effectively over, and peace commissioners from the United States and Great Britain are descending upon Paris, where they are supposed to hash out a treaty between both themselves and with the French. Richard Oswald, a one-eyed Scotsman who has a great affinity for America, he's the first one there, and he and Benjamin Franklin, they get to talking. They're old friends. And the game is afoot the moment these two are in the same city. Richard tries to put a wedge between the United States and France to try and get them to make a separate peace, to get the Americans to come to the table without their French allies. And Ben wants to push for Britain to give more. He wants to ask Britain to hand over the whole of Canada. Now, he comes with a list of reasons why that even makes good sense for Britain. Richard listens and ultimately asks Ben if he can have the list. And Ben hands over his page of notes. But then on the way back, it dawns on him, those notes did hint at some of the ways that the Americans didn't always treat the loyalists well. So, what's he gonna do? This undercuts his whole argument that Britain really owes a lot to the Americans because of war atrocities. Well, he turns to his own press and he drafts a complete fabrication, an alleged supplement of a real Boston newspaper. And he tells this story with great detail of a New England militia intercepting British forces, taking a collection of, you know, what you would think are animal skins, but as they open the bags, it's the scalps of Americans, of patriots, not just men, but women, children, little infants even. He adds a fake letter from John Paul Jones, the most celebrated and best known patriot on the seas. He dates it even. He puts an issue number on it that all aligns perfectly for this to be a paper that has just come off the press in Boston and barely made it across the Atlantic. All these details have been complemented with advertisements. And again, Ben's making all of this up. And then he sends that out to his colleagues as though it's a real newspaper, wholly expecting and hoping that it will, if I could use a 21st century expression, go viral. And it does. It gets reproduced in British newspapers, which, of course, sours the mood there, shifting public opinion. We can debate the extent to which this really had an impact on negotiations, but at the end of the day, Benjamin Franklin, in 1782, made a fake edition of a real newspaper with a fake story to move public opinion to accomplish a political act. It is textbook fake news, and it's right at the beginning of our nation.
We are living in a dangerous and unprecedented moment in American history.
That is absolutely true.
Nothing like this has ever happened before, and we don't know how this ends.
I am sick of living through unprecedented. It's been happening since I was bored.
Why does every day feel like one for the history books? Life shouldn't be a Hank Green crash course video.
We are all going to perish if we don't get that maniac off of Pennsylvania Avenue.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
One of the things that I want to combat with this book is this idea that we are facing unprecedented new challenges, and among them being fake news. We've convinced ourselves that somehow media was always trustworthy before then, and now the United States is facing a war of misinformation unlike any generation, and therefore democracy is going to fail. And what I want to remind the reader with fake news, contested elections, and political violence, I want us to remember that no, these are not new challenges. These are challenges that American democracy has been facing from day one. So all these golden eras that anyone might look back to and say, oh, that's when things were great. Well, these challenges already existed. We've been facing and defeating them generation after generation. So that should bring us to have hope, and let's let go of our cynicism and our defeatist attitude and think that we can't do it today when we've already done it so many times before.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Greg Jackson is an associate professor at Utah Valley University. He's host of the podcast History That Doesn't Suck. His new book is called Been There, Done That. And really, the best way to get at the larger point Jackson is making in the book comes from Mark Twain, something he may have said, something attributed to him anyway, that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes.
We can always claim that it's an unprecedented moment. Well, because today is a new day. This right. day has never come before, right? Yeah. We can always split hairs and talk about how this iteration of a bigger issue has never been faced. But that's exactly my point, is that it is an iteration. So, yeah, history doesn't repeat itself. It's not going to be exactly the same thing. I'm not here to push some particular cycle of nations, but rather this idea that it rhymes. So fake news today, yes, we can carve little idiosyncrasies that might be unique and different, but the large, looming, major issue, no, that is not different. And that's the point I really want Americans to grasp. To me, that's where the hope is at, the recognition that we're the same brilliant and stupid, generous and stingy, you name it, species that we've always been. And even as technology shifts, changes, we have information revolutions of various sorts, we really do fall into similar patterns, facing disruption, figuring out how to handle that disruption, selfish motivations and generosity, all trying to operate within a representative government. There really isn't as much new as we like to think.
So what you're saying is, don't get caught up in the differences in the platforms or the technology. Yes, there wasn't a Twitter or social media back in the 18th century. But there's a pattern here as in a story, and you're trying to get people to identify the connections, the trends, and the patterns there.
Absolutely. I mean, let's – if we could just barge into chapter one for a second, the Gazette War – between the emerging first political parties, the Jeffersonian Republicans and the Federalists. Okay, so the nation couldn't even get through the Washington administration without inventing the first two national newspapers and both of them yelling and screaming at each other and hurling all sorts of accusations at the other, claims that the other is trying to destroy the country with their clearly evil policies.
Yeah,
right? I hear a lot of rhyming in everything I just said. First off. Yeah. But, you know, there's no Twitter, fine. But you do have founding fathers themselves, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison come to mind, publishing under pseudonyms. So basically the same idea as having a fake account on social media.
Right.
Publishing all sorts of lies about the other, slamming the other. And the American reader is left to, what, try and sort that out?
Why do we feel this is different, though? Have you thought a little bit about that impulse to say, Look, that was another time. Yes, they may have been violent, but people were violent back then. We're different. We're not the same. What is the – is it an impulse of human nature to think that this is completely different from another time?
Yeah. Oh, it super is. I mean, one of the fascinating things to me in both this book and, well, all the projects I've undertaken is seeing how every generation is convinced that they are the ones facing this unique time period, that the technology is unlike anything. And look, you're right on technology being new and cutting edge. That is the case for every generation.
Yeah.
The thing is, the technology then follows a very similar pattern. It disrupts, and then we find a new stability. So we can talk about how Twitter's new, how AI is new, but then when we get to, say, yellow journalism, we also need to acknowledge how the industrial steam press was new, and printing in color was new, and it was absolutely tearing apart and disrupting the print media of the day in a way that no one had ever seen before. So that's where that rhyme again comes in, right? And every generation does carry this, well, really, it's the fear of the unknown. Because we look at these past generations, in fact, to get to something I intentionally point out would be a ridiculous thing to compare to the present, the Civil War.
Yeah.
You know, we can read about the Battle of Antietam, the bloodiest single day in American history ever, over 20,000 American casualties. And yet, even as we read it, we're not feeling this anxiety of, oh my gosh, how does it turn out? There's this peace and calm that comes with the realization that the Civil War ends, that the United States endures, that slavery ends with the 13th Amendment. And so we read it with the calm of knowing that things are, you know, from our perspective in the 21st century, going to be okay. Well, that's not the calm you have if you're an American living in the 1860s, right? What you know is the worst battle ever fought in American history has ravaged the nation, and you're still not knowing how the Civil War is going to turn out. So it's the anxiety of the blank page before you, I think, that leads us to sometimes feel this undaunting fear of the unknown, and it becomes harder for us to recognize that the same pressures and fears we're feeling are, in fact, what our predecessors also felt.
You have said that when you started the book, at first, if I have this right, that you were you figured you're writing history, but then as you got into the chapters about, again, all of these things, that some of which we'll talk about, you know, contested elections and political violence and, you know, the use of rhetoric, that you said you pierced the present veil. It was like it was a moment when you realized it wasn't just about history, but was also about the present. Can you talk a little bit about that moment for you?
Yeah, it was a terrifying moment, to be candid, Doug. I take very seriously the fact that I am a historian, and I don't aspire to be a reporter. I try to keep a fairly clear line, and part of that is that, you know, the historian... There's so much overlap between us and say, you know, a reporter writing for a newspaper.
Yeah.
In terms of our approach, methodology, but reporters face different challenges in that, one, emotions are higher, right? People have strong feelings about what's going on right now compared to things that are in the past. The past, it brings some emotion, but not on the same level. And also the historian has the luxury of all of the sources being available. So that's another piece. In short, I never intended to really touch the present. And as I initially conceived this book, I would point out these important moments in the past. I was really grateful to my editor, though, as she continued to kind of push and press me and say, Greg, you know, you're talking about how these things really do resonate and echo into the present. You're going to need to bring more of that to the table. And it forced me, Doug, to think harder about not just saying, well, look, the election of 1876 was bad, so, you know, it was worse than 2020, and kind of leaving it at that. But also seeing the connective tissue. For instance, I found myself drifting a little bit more into political thought than I ever have as a historian, as a podcaster, and a professor, kind of broaching, you know, that neighboring field of ours, that is political science. Thinking through James Madison's writings, the explanations of how our constitutional republic specifically functions.
Yeah.
But you know, the terrifying part, to really get to the heart of your question, that came in realizing that there was no way for me to leave any part of myself hidden from the reader. There's a, I think the best word I can use here is like an intellectual nakedness that I had to embrace. And particularly, it came with the election of 1876. Chapter 7 is on the election of 1876, yep. But it is so, it comes up so many times on January 6th in the aftermath of the election of 2020. It's cited so many times by Republicans, no less, that I knew that I couldn't write a book talking about how these past events connected to the present and ignore that. And so my stare into the deep dark abyss turned into perhaps stepping into the deep dark abyss to really think about the connective tissue between the past and the present.
Okay, so I want to get back to, you mentioned those newspaper wars of the 1790s. I want to get back to that story because I want to get us to James Madison and his ideas about faction or, you know, partisanship, what he means by it. So set up these wars for us. So this is of course, as you sort of said, this is the beginning of the American Republic. We're right at the beginning. George Washington is president. The Constitution is brand new. And a lot of people are thinking, oh, this is a time of, you know, unity. But of course, there are these two camps that are emerging, Alexander Hamilton on one side, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison on the other. Set up the context for this for us.
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of easier to play nice when there's an external enemy. So, you know, you've got the Founding Fathers. First of all, let's not overstate their agreement during the Revolution. They disagreed on plenty of things.
Yeah.
But there's that unifying piece that we all agree King George III needs to go.
Right.
Okay. Well, now you got to govern. Now you got to run this nation. And very quickly, we start seeing the different ideas. So Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, these are our main players, I would say. So Alex, as I do like to call these guys by their first names.
Yes, you
I like
do.
To feel there's
That's
a,
great.
There's a bond, Doug. Yeah. You know, we're
Tommy and Alex, yes.
Tommy and Alex, yeah. Absolutely. So Alex is asked to tackle this debt issue. And to not belabor in any points, I'll cut to him suggesting that the federal government assume, you know, take on the debts of the states. This is a terrifying notion to the states that don't have as much debt. And it sounds like a great idea to the states that have a lot of debt, all hanging over from the Revolution. And of course, the argument being, well, pay your own way. And the other being, well, some states had more fighting to deal with. We directly engaged with the British. Our blood and treasure was for your benefit as well. So, you know, we should split the bill. At this point, they're able to work it out. They come to a you know, if you've seen Hamilton, Lin-Manuel's Hamilton, right? Mm-hmm. This is the room where it happens, that song, where they hash out this deal where Tom and little Jemmy, our boy James Madison, these two Virginians, they're able to be coaxed into doing this assumption plan if the federal capital heads to the south. And it's why Washington, D.C. is located where it is today. So that was okay. But then Alex suggests a bank, a national bank. Now, it's still not the centralized banking system that a typical nation has today. This, for Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, this is the proof that Alexander Hamilton, he doesn't just have different ideas. He wants to destroy America, American liberty. He wants to turn this into a kingdom under a King George Washington and make himself the first minister of this new, you know, tyrannical monarchy. So 3 days after George Washington signs the bank bill into law, they decide to start a newspaper, and they go and get one of the greatest polemicists out there, Philip Freneau, Thomas Jefferson, our Secretary of State. He hires Freneau as a translator at State, knowing that the position really is just useless.
Yeah.
His real job is to use his federally funded position to live off of while he runs a partisan press that's going to attack the Washington administration in which Thomas Jefferson's serving. I mean, that's nuts.
Yeah.
And we'll note that this is opposite another paper, the Gazette of the United States.
Yeah.
So we have the National Gazette under Freneau, and there's the Gazette of the United States. This is the first national media, proper national media we have. And it very quickly turns into the Gazette of the United States being the Federalist paper and the National Gazette being the Jeffersonian Republican paper. And they are just slamming each other.
Yeah, it's extraordinary how at some point they have the initial idea that they're going to be objective. And it doesn't take long before that breaks down.
Not at all.
Right? And so what do you see as the lesson from that? Because then what you have is Hamilton and Madison doing these anonymous op-ed pieces, basically, calling each other out. And this is, again, in the early years of the country. We were already establishing what we were talking about before, and that is a pattern.
Yeah. It speaks to, and I don't want this to be a downer, okay, Doug? But we're going to start with the negative here. It speaks to the inevitability of partisanship.
Yeah.
And this is what James Madison himself, before he succumbed to it, what he pointed to in Federalist Number 10.
Yep.
Now, in Federalist Number 10, he talks about how liberty basically breeds factionalism. Right? Factionalism is the word he uses. We'd say partisanship today. And he makes a really great point with this analogy where he compares how liberty and factionalism are basically like oxygen and fire.
Right.
Liberty is a necessary element of food, right? A thing. For partisanship, because liberty means you can have different opinions. So, boom, that's partisanship. Similarly, you can't have fire without oxygen. And he points out it would be ridiculous to get rid of oxygen and thereby kill off all life because you don't want to deal with fire, right? We'd all rather be alive. Similarly, we can't kill liberty because we don't want to deal with partisanship. So it's there. Now,
and he says, he says it's a good thing, though, right? He says this is the thing that is, and I think this is an important point, because people see this sort of partisanship or this faction as inherently a bad thing for civil society. It seems like what Madison's saying is, look, this is how it works. It has to be present in order to get to that more perfect union. Is that right?
Well, He comes to that.
He comes to that. Yeah.
Yeah. So in Federalist Number 10, he says, look, the best way to fight factionalism is a massive republic. So we're going to have all sorts of factions in these small republics that are each of the states. But in a big republic, the United States, no single faction will ever be able to run amok. Well, okay, that didn't hold up. So he shifts, though, once rubber has met the road, and now he has practical experience. Now we're into the Gazette Wars. He's dealing with Alexander Hamilton's Federalist ideas. And yeah, as things are heating up with the French, and Alexander Hamilton's just making incredible points in one op-ed after the next, of course, under a pseudonym. And he's very much selling his vision that the executive has the power over foreign policy, not Congress, which Thomas Jefferson and James Madison disagree with. Tom writes to Little Jimmy, right, to James Madison, and says, for God's sake, pick up your pen, take up your pen, select some of his most damning heresies, and I quote, cut him to pieces in the face of the public.
Yeah.
So here you have, right, the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, and here he is ordering a political hit to be delivered by the father of the Constitution and to be carried out on the primary author of the Federalist Papers.
In the newspaper. He's like, go after him in the paper. Like, make this case to the public. Yeah.
Yes, make this case to the public. Yeah. So, I mean, again, if that doesn't to return to where we went before that tangent, with that very fun and worthwhile tangent, the inevitability of partisanship.
Yep.
These are the guys who put forth all of our most noble ideas, and here they are descending to this sort of a low, ripping each other to shreds in the newspapers.
It's so interesting. You mentioned how what Madison makes of faction early on, and the way he describes it in number 10, that Federalist paper. Let me read it. He says, "The latent causes of faction are sown in the nature of man, and we see them everywhere brought into different degrees of activity according to the different circumstances of civil society." So sown in the nature of man, it seems like what he's saying is it's inherent in us, or I think as you put it in your book, people suck.
Yes, that's he got that. James Madison completely understood that yeah. People suck. And you know that brings us to Federalist 51, where he says, hey, if men were angels, there'd be no need for government.
Right.
So, that's an important piece of Madisonian thought, is understanding that people suck. And that's why you need strong institutions and guardrails to protect us from those worst aspects. And that's where Madison hoped that a large United States, that this massive republic would protect us. And when he sees, it's not working, right? The Federalist Party arises immediately. That's when he gets on board with, okay, fine. We will fight fire with fire. We're going to start our own party. Mm. And it's going to take on that evil Federalist Party. And boom, you now have a two-party system.
Let's jump forward, as you do in the book, to the War of 1812. The United States is still pretty young, still pretty fragile. Once again, we find ourselves at war with Great Britain, and the tensions are basically over these, you know, trade restrictions and what kind of, you know, nation the U.S. is going to become on the world stage, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And the fight really breaks out in a really interesting way in Baltimore. Because here in Baltimore, the city's, again, divided between these two notions. The Federalists, who are critical of the war, and they don't like James Madison's leadership. He's president now. And then you have those who support the war effort. And then you've got newspapers who are basically fanning these divisions and this political rhetoric. And it just goes crazy, gets out of hand. Set up what happens.
Yeah. So the war is declared. Congress at this point is a supermajority under the Jeffersonian Republican Party. And Federalists they still exist across the country, but really they only have any meaningful power in the Northeast at this point. So a staunch Federalist there in Baltimore, Alexander Hansen, he has the Federal Republican, it's a Federalist supporting paper, and he just slams Congress, he slams James Madison, who's now president, says that they're, you know, James is going to be a puppet of Napoleon. Let's remember that the Napoleonic Wars are going on. But he cries foul that this is awful, and he even says that, I'm slightly paraphrasing, but this is the exact sentiment. If you think that this is a good idea, you're stupid. You don't understand. You're an idiot. And the Jeffersonian Republicans, or at least a large element within the party, they respond by literally tearing down his office building.
Literally.
Literally. He goes down there. He tries to intercede. You've got hundreds, if not thousands, watching as somewhere between 30 to 50 men, they are using clubs, rope, hooks, you name it, to rip down the building. And the Federal Republicans, publishers, the editors, they respond by setting up a new press, this time out in the D.C. area. Smart. And and they make another edition. And this time, Alex, a real fighter, this guy, he has an op-ed entitled Mobocracy. And now he complains about Mayor Edward Johnson. He complains about the mayor. the government as a whole. And Doug, I love this line. In it, he complains about his newspaper being torn down and, of course, the literal attack on the freedom of the press, right? First Amendment right. He opines that such a thing could happen. Again, I'm paraphrasing, but I'm almost quoting. That such a thing could happen in this most enlightened and free nation in the world.
This is how we think today.
Bingo, yeah, right? Yeah. Again, it rhymes, Doug. Yeah. It rhymes. We do this over and over. And the response to this one is the new office located at 45 Charles Street. The Republicans come out again in full force. They attack. This time, the Federalists are ready for the siege. Of course, as they see it, they're defending the First Amendment. They are not being aggressors. If the mob attacks the House, though, they will respond in kind. Well, the attack comes. Shots are fired. A warning volley into the sky first. Eventually, Republicans charge through the front door, fully armed. Well, Doug, what do you do if a mob charges through your front door armed? The Federalists fire. A man dies. All of this continues to escalate. And after a bit of a ceasefire, they are escorted by militia leaders to the jail where they are told they are being held for their own protection, right? Protective custody. Republicans are being told that they're being held because, of course, these Federalists are criminals. So two different narratives. But the Republicans ultimately, this mob of Republicans, charge into the jail. They break down doors to attack the Federalists. About half of them get away, but the other half, there were a total of about two dozen. One dozen are caught, and they are gruesomely tortured. I mean, the Saw movie sort of torture. In the midst of all this, they're discussing what they should do to James Lingon. Now, James is a former Continental Army officer, and many of them know his story. They know that he was a prisoner of the British. He was held on a British prison ship, which is about the cruelest, worst experience any American fighting for the Patriot cause could have experienced during the war. It was all but a death sentence. And the British even tried to get him to turn. They offered him a handsome payout to commission into the British forces. He refused to do so. And as they're now debating what they do with him, some of them saying, oh, it doesn't matter what a war hero he was. Now he's a Federalist, so he's a traitor. James pulls open his shirt, and you can see the purplish, gnarled skin where a Hessian bayonet ripped through his chest as a young man. In 1776, in the midst of the Continental Army's full retreat from New York, you know, to that dire moment in December when Thomas Paine would say, these are times that try men's souls, and George Washington would lead that revolution-saving attack against the Hessians, that Christmas attack. James lets them see this Hessian bayonet scar and asks, does this look as if I were a traitor? And in that moment, the response of the mob, someone hurls a stone as hard as they can. It strikes James right on the scar, knocking him over, and then they fall on him with their penknives. And this hero of the revolution is dead within hours because he had the wrong partisan views in the eyes of his fellow Baltimoreans.
Well, and then you say that when all of that, when the bloodbath sort of ends, the Republican men held hands and danced around the Federalists while singing this song. Like, it yep. sounds really diabolical. It sounds awful.
It is all that, Doug. And at the same time, it's important for us to understand that this is a place the human mind can go. That this is where partisanship can hijack our brains and take us to such a simplistic two-dimensional good versus evil level of thinking that we can cease to see the humanity of our fellow Americans. And that's exactly where that mob was. And yet, you know, not to dismiss that horrid scene. Mm-hmm. These men are singing. Their wives are there singing right along with them. Some of them have their children there, and their kids are being taught this hatred as they skip about as well. Then when it's all said and done and the emotions start to ebb, the prison doctor, he's taking the surviving Federalists to operate, right, to try and save lives. He knows they are all as good as dead if he can't get to work immediately. Some of the very men who carried out this attack suddenly turn around and they start helping to carry these Federalists into the hospital. Doug, it's you know, the mob mentality is fading as the moment passes. It's a terrifying lesson in human tribalism. Mm. And it's a lesson that we ignore at our own peril.
Greg Jackson, he's an associate professor of political science at Utah Valley University, host of the podcast History That Doesn't Suck. His new book is Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Utah historian Greg Jackson about his new book, Been There, Done That. And the idea is there in the title. Jackson is looking at the history of the country from the early republic, and he's making this argument that the crises we think are unique to our time have actually happened before. From political violence to fake news to contentious elections, Jackson says the patterns aren't new, even if the context is. I want to come back to Madison for a minute, because I want to, for the sake of argument, push back on your premise.
Do it.
Madison says that partisanship, or faction, as he puts it, is a key component to liberty. He writes, liberty, as you're saying, is to faction what air is to fire.
Mm-hmm.
And you say just the mere existence of oxygen doesn't mean we have to, you know, as you put it in the book, live life in a raging inferno.
Yeah.
So that's important. And then Madison also says, and this is a point you make, we have these enduring institutions that are in place that can survive these moments. Madison said a well-constructed union has the advantage to be able to break and control the violence of faction. But I think people are going to, and I'm sure you're hearing this as you travel the country on this book tour, they're going to say, but Professor, this is different. Which is, again, going against the basic premise of your book. But people who are mm-hmm. saying that, as you say, the founders managed to establish these institutions that are durable when one person or one party tries to, you know, go too far. But there's this argument being made right now. I know you've heard it, of course, that the Republican Party, in this case, who controls the legislative branch, the conservatives who hold the majority of the Supreme Court, they've conceded or have neglected their role as a check on the executive branch. And that makes this somehow different. Would you push back on my pushback? Respond to that.
Gladly, yes. Yeah, this is partisanship doing its worst. At the same time, this is a far cry from a foregone conclusion that the House is going to burn down. I don't see us at that point yet. My biggest concern actually is hearing that argument and the cynicism that's built into it.
Hmm.
That is, in my mind, the biggest concern. We have an election coming up,
yeah,
and this is an opportunity if Americans hold the premise that you just put forward, right? And yes, I hear plenty of it. Well, this is an opportunity for Americans to use their vote to deny the Republicans the same control that they currently have of Congress, right? Mm. Well, that requires the American voter to believe in the system enough to show up and vote. That requires the American voter to do their homework, to participate, and also to use their voice. Because, look, I'm actually going to pivot to chapter 4 here, to Charles Sumner's caning.
Oh, I'm glad, because that's where I want to head. So good.
Oh, wonderful. So look, if our elected representatives, okay, let's embrace the premise here,
yeah,
that our legislators are across the board, abandoning ship, and not doing their job.
Yeah.
Well, we've given them the permission to do that. And an example of us doing that in the past is the caning of Charles Sumner,
right,
where Preston Brooks bashes a senator to within an inch of his life in the Capitol building itself. He resigns after.
Wait. You've got to tell the story.
Okay.
Do not speed past this, dude. This is a great story. I mean, so this is 1856. The country's headed towards civil war. The issue is, of course, slavery, and tensions are exploding about whether new territories like Kansas, in this case, are going to enter the Union as free or slave states. And so the debate is pretty ferocious. And Sumner, almost better than the story of what happens to him, is the speech that he gives and the way he prepares for it and the way – I don't know. Just set this up for us. Take a moment if you don't mind.
Yeah, so Charles Sumner, he's one of your OG abolitionists, and very much an isolated voice initially, and but he understands the technology and the media of his day. Today, he would be crushing it on social media, I have no doubt.
Yeah.
Because he gets that when he speaks on the Senate floor, he's not actually speaking to his colleagues. Right? His speech is a mailer. Right. He's going to do a mass mailing. It's basically like having an email list or a large social media following. And it's not just going to be him, but reporters are going to be in the room taking down what he says. So Americans across the nation are going to read it. So even though he represents Massachusetts, and even though he's trying to make laws in D.C., right, he's going to wield this massive influence. So he crafts this carefully prepared, hours long. He actually has to split it up. He delivers it over 2 days, several hours both days. The point of the speech is that Kansas should not permit slavery, that it should be free. But, it's a performance piece as much as anything else. Yeah. He is illustrating his erudition, that the man is citing every political thinker you could imagine, American, you know, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson. Rome is getting cited, you know, even more than we have recently heard on social media, what all men are thinking about all the time.
Yeah.
And then he goes for the throat. He talks about the slave power, and he talks about the specific legislators, his colleagues, who are in bed with the slave power. And I'm not the one who comes up with the sexual allusions. That's Charles Sumner.
Yeah.
So he says that Senator Andrew Butler, that his harlot is slave power. And he even mocks Andrew Butler's partially paralyzed face as he alludes to how the man can't even speak well for himself. As Charles Sumner makes these slams, you know, what we forget about today is the honor culture of the 19th century. And Preston Brooks, a cousin of sorts, a kin to Andrew Butler, with a long history of dueling and fighting, and his understanding that is his duty as a Southern gentleman when honor has been insulted, he feels compelled to stand against Charles Sumner for this slanderous speech in Preston's view. So, you know, we now fast forward just a few days, and Preston Brooks has debated in his mind what he should do exactly. Does he challenge Charles Sumner to a duel? Well, no, he decides not to, because at this point it's well known that those Yankees aren't fighters. Mm-hmm. So he decides that, no, he's going to cane Charles Sumner, because that's what a gentleman does to someone who is his lesser, who is not a gentleman, and is not deserving of a properly challenged duel. So he goes into the Senate chamber. There's Charles Sumner at his desk. He's preparing mailers of this speech that he delivered. And so he's sitting there, and he's waiting for this woman to leave, because, again, a gentleman would never commit such an act of violence in the presence of a lady. And finally, she leaves. When he does, he gets up. He's clutching his 11-and-a-half-ounce cane, walks up to Charles Sumner. There's some debate on his precise language, but effectively he announces to Charles, you have spoken slander and libel against my state, which is, again, South Carolina, and against my kin. And with that, he just goes to town.
Yeah.
Whacks him on the head. Charles doesn't even know, you know, no time to react. Another blow comes. He goes blacked out. His vision just disappears. He's still conscious, but think about what kind of trauma the brain has suffered for his vision to just go out like a light.
Yeah.
And then he can feel the hot blood pouring down his face. Now, the chairs roll back and the desks at this point are bolted to the floors. The trauma that Charles has just suffered, the urgency, right, the fight or flight kicking in, he can't remember to push his chair back. So he's just stuck in this as Preston just takes this cane, I mean, effectively a small baseball bat, right, and just strikes again and again and again, cracking his skull. Finally, Charles, the adrenaline, you know, ripping through this 6'4" massive Bostonian, he rips the desk from its bolts and stands. But by this point, he's already been pummeled and bashed so much. Preston, only 6 foot, grabs him by the lapel and continues to just crack him over the head. As he does, his fellow South Carolinians are blocking off any other legislators who might dare to intercede, threatening with their own canes. Representative Kitts exclaims at one senator, "You let them alone, God damn you." That's a quote. And Preston Brooks just continues to wallop him. Charles starts to fall into the hallway. The cane cracks. It breaks in his hand. Preston himself even suffers a small laceration on his face from the flying splinters. And he just continues to bash and bash and bash. And Preston, you know, I think, Doug, this probably lands more for Utahns than it does for some of my readers in large cities. Utah's still agricultural enough to understand what this means. But Preston Brooks later writes to, I believe it was his brother, and says that toward the end, Sumner bellowed, quote, "He bellowed like a calf." This just visceral, you know, dying screams and the pain that's tearing through him. Finally, he stops as representatives and senators do manage to get in there, and two New Yorkers basically catch Charles as he, you know, falls to the ground. Instantly, a pool of blood around his head, and he blacks out, and he's carried into the other room to be attended to while Preston Brooks washes his hands, grabs the gold head of his cane that had flown off, and goes and grabs dinner with friends.
Wow. Well, let me bring you back to where you were headed with that. And thanks for doing
Absolutely.
That. Because you say in the book, here's the 21st century $64,000 question. Here's the 20th mm-hmm. century, you know, bringing us back to you know, the question that I was getting at before. And you, as you say, here's the question. Is the United States facing another existential crisis? A choice tantamount to being a republic of liberty or enslavement? And you say it isn't. So, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt the point, but keep going with the point.
Yeah. Well, yeah, frankly, it isn't. That's my perspective. And, you know, the Civil War, this was a moment of existential crisis in which the slave power, to again use the term from the era, they were so threatened at the loss of an economy built upon slavery that they were ready to rend the Union. I cannot personally think of, despite our differences, and I'm aware of what political, you know, issues and positions Republicans and Democrats have, I just can't point to something that is such a pressing equivalent to that. And when we reelect people to Congress who have had bad behavior, we tell them that that is the is not in fact bad behavior, that we expect and we like that behavior. And that's exactly what happened with Preston. So he's, of course, investigated. And of course, it's a partisan game where Republicans say he needs to be kicked out of Congress and Democrats say he doesn't need to. And so they can't get the numbers. Preston, being a gentleman, he resigns. Mm. And he resigns and is immediately reelected to his seat, Doug, with a 30% increase in support. With countless South Carolinians sending him canes that have been inscribed with "hit him again." So we can say, why doesn't Congress do better? Let's recall, looking into, you know, the 1850s here, that when this man, when Preston Brooks carried out the most egregious act of violence in our Congress's history, his people, right, his constituents, took his resignation, threw it in the trash bin, and sent him back with more gusto. And that signaled to the entire United States,
how South Carolina felt, and the fact that you didn't have outcries from other states, right? It signals as well that, yeah, that we approve of this sort of behavior. So if year after year we send the same people back to Congress and they are okay with the amounts that the executive branch is or is not, you know, doing this or that, well, we're signaling that we're okay with that, Doug. For me, the outcome of this book was a greater reassurance of the power of the people. This really is government by the people. And I understand the counterarguments of gerrymandering and policies that might lessen the vote. This nation has come to the greatness that it is because people who didn't even have the vote had the audacity to fight back, like Frederick Douglass, like Alice Paul, you know, and so many others. And it's expanded the vote to what it is today. Right? Well, I'm giving you examples from a limited republic. Mm. I end in 1900. I end in the midst of Jim Crow and a pre-19th Amendment United States,
right.
You know, meaning that women still don't have the vote either.
Yeah,
I don't even get to the point where all adult American citizens have the vote. That is the America you and I inhabit today. So the idea that we can have the audacity to say that this is beyond repair, I really invite my fellow Americans to reconsider what that says. You know, could you look Frederick Douglass in the eye if he rose from the grave today and say that you have a harder fight ahead of you than him? I'm sorry if I got a little fired up there, but I really do believe in government by the people, and I believe it's real.
Greg Jackson, we're talking about his new book. It's called Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Greg Jackson. We're talking about his new book, Been There, Done That.
Well, you end the book by coming back to this focus on the individual. And you argue, this is a really important theme, I think, throughout the book, that perspective, looking at history and understanding it, encourages resilience, not complacency. So, yes. And you mentioned this letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote from Paris to a friend, George Wythe, where he talks about education being critical for the preservation of liberty. And I wanted you to say something about that, if that's okay. And it's interesting, we should also contrast that with Thomas Jefferson's other letter that he writes to James Madison saying, cut him to pieces in a newspaper. I mean, these are complicated people.
Well, and Doug, that's because people are complicated,
yeah.
Right? So, yeah, Thomas Jefferson, he was a huge supporter of public education. He says that basically you can't afford to not have public education because a republic requires educated voters. And, you know, this isn't a part of the book, but I will add that in the midst of Reconstruction, the era after the Civil War, one of the impetuses for a lot of states really funding public education are the fact that we now have newly enfranchised freedmen, right? Formerly enslaved Black Americans who need to vote, and the realization that, well, they're illiterate because it was illegal to teach the enslaved to read. Mm-hmm. And that was all part of how the system was perpetuated, because there's nothing more dangerous than someone who can read. Right? That's what endangers power. That's where you get people who think and push back. So I think that perfectly complements what Tom is driving at here. And it's, of course, part of my passion for, you know, being an educator, the career that I have carved out and followed, and why I've done this podcast and written this book and toured the nation. We have to understand civics. We have to understand history. And I'm a pragmatic person. I understand education for the sake of employment. I get, you know, the various majors we have today. But also there's a reason why general ed is there, that the necessity of having those basics of critical thinking skills, understanding of how the American system even works, so that you can be an engaged voter.
Yeah.
Basically, in short, the government uses or should use public funding to invest in American education, because that's what keeps the republic going. You have to teach people how to read, how to think, and how our system works.
And you say right now it's never been easier to get good information, but it's also never been easier to get really bad information. And you mentioned that we need to filter it from the flood of misinformation. Would you say a little bit more about that? How do people do that? You say we have to be more responsible than the algorithm.
Yeah, I think that there is this – and look, I get it. It's new. We've had this disruption, okay? Yeah. And disruption always – it's disorienting, right? It's like you just got – you just got punched in the face. You didn't see it coming. Fair enough. Algorithms, AI, even social media, as familiar as that is to us now, that's still new. And it's disrupted our world. Okay, well, it's time for us to collectively realize that, you know, remember, we've got to be in charge of our own decisions. Compare yourself to an American in the 19th century, right? You live in a small farming community. You've got the choice of maybe one or two newspapers. I would actually say that the algorithms today, we can talk about the systems they create and the, you know, the microcosms that people exist within. Okay, maybe apples and oranges to some degree, but I think there's an argument to be made that, in fact, being able to access a multitude of perspectives, if you so choose today, through the internet, well, that gives you perspective that someone living in the echo chamber of a small rural community with one newspaper and one pulpit never could have broken away from. So remember that all of this information also means you have more access to information than any other generation. But just as you got to think about what you're putting into your body if you care about your physical health, well, stop letting the algorithms push you around. And, you know, subscribe to newspapers, both those with which you agree and those with which you disagree. Get that other perspective. That's what's going to sharpen your mind into a place to not only better understand how you want to vote, but you can't have a meaningful dialogue with your fellow American who disagrees with you if you don't understand where they're coming from. That's something we need to improve on.
Let's end with Abraham Lincoln, as you do in the book, with a quote. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. You're the eternal optimist, you say. What do you hear in Abraham Lincoln here?
Our capacity to choose to endure in perpetuity forever. I think that, you know, I'll go ahead and embrace 250. It's America 250. The Constitution is obviously younger than that. But for 250 years, we have been these United States. And we have, even if we didn't get to the Constitution iteration, right, these enduring principles, this audacious idea that we would build a society with unalienable rights, that we are created equal. If we so choose, we can continue that. And I believe that by looking into the deepest, darkest moments of our history, which is exactly what I did to write this book, and seeing that our incredible infrastructure built by founders who understood that people suck have endured. And that opposite of that, right? That another aspect I do touch on in the book, that public virtue, yes, we need institutions that can endure the worst of people, but also that we do rely on a public morality. I see that public morality, even if it wanes and waxes, it always came through. You know, we have our Abraham Lincolns. We have our Charles Sumners. I mean, Charles Sumner, Doug, after he was beaten and he's clearly concussed and it takes him years to almost recover, he never fully recovers. That same night he gets home from the beating, he gets home and tells his colleagues, okay, I just need to keep fighting. Those Americans exist, and I've seen that they exist in every generation. So I don't know who is necessarily today's Charles Sumner or Abraham Lincoln, but I'm telling you that they are there. And I believe that data, that 250 years of data, it leads me to conclude that we will continue to make the choices. This isn't a Pollyanna guarantee that we will endure, but that pattern speaks to a continued commitment from enough public virtue-seeking Americans to carry us forward.
Greg Jackson, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Greg Jackson, he's the host of the podcast History That Doesn't Suck. He's an associate professor at Utah Valley University. His book is Been There, Done That, How Our History Shows What We Can Overcome. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.